Good morning and welcome everybody. I'm Tom Gillesberg, head of the Schiller Institute in Denmark and also the Copenhagen office of our international publication, the EII magazine, you all seen. And I'm very happy to see you here today for a very special occasion, I would say. We have as a unique, very special guest, Helga Sattler-Rouge, the wife of Lyndon LaRouche, the American economist and statesman, and as I think Helga will lay out, the only person or economist or politicians or whatever that consistently over the last decades has been able to predict what actually would happen with the economy and then have proposed remedies to actually deal with it. This seminar is part of a new tradition we're trying to set up here in Copenhagen of having in the diplomatic community and also with some of our other EIR subscribers a real discussion of the urgent and the pressing bigger political issues that should be on everybody's mind and that everybody should be discussing, but that we know that in normal day-to-day diplomatic relations don't really come much into issue. It's much more smaller and petty things which normally are discussed, and therefore we think it's very important to bring the diplomatic community together to discuss the real issues, the life and death issues of our nations. And I will say, you can see we have a video camera. It's simply to record the opening remarks and then we'll turn it off so we can have a free discussion, so to speak, off the record. It's mainly for those who are not, for different reasons, were not able to be here, that they at least can hear the preliminary remarks and in that way be somewhat informed. As an introduction of Helga Sattler-Rouge, I will say that she's, of course, for the last many decades has been a very key player in German political life as being a source of real ideas and real solutions which are normally have not been discussed in the, what you could say, the established German political life enough. So she has been consistently coming out with, in much the same way as Lyndon LaRouche has been doing in the United States, with real analysis of the pressing issues of the German nation and the world and how Germany as a nation should deal with it. She's been doing that as head of the EAP political party in Germany since 1974 and since 1992 as the head of Bürgerrechtsbewegung Solidarität, the civil rights movement Solidarity, who has been running in and is running in all of the German elections. But at the same time, she has also been a very key global political figure to actually, like her husband Lyndon LaRouche, to actually come out with not only analysis of the situation, but also solutions. She's been married to Lyndon LaRouche for over 30 years and been his closest political collaborator in this. And therefore, she has also been having a tremendous amount of initiatives like the founding of the Schiller Institute in 1984, many other things. At the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, when Mr. LaRouche was political prisoner in the United States, Helga Sattler-Rouge became the focal point of trying to put together a economic development policy for Europe at this time to actually use this great opportunity to make Europe a locomotive for the world economy, because at the time the German government had no clue what to do. They had no contingency plan for what to do if East Germany collapsed. And very quickly after that, that also, this program of economic development called the Productive Triangle became extended to the Eurasian land bridge, to the idea of having infrastructure corridors between Europe all the way over Asia, to include all of Europe and Asia as the continent, going to China, of course, going through Russia and so on and so forth, going to India. And as part of the of the mobilizations for getting this realized, Helga Seppler-Rusch was also traveling extensively to Asia, to China, where she was known as the Silk Road Lady for making this effort. To Russia, of course, where Mr. LaRouche has been adopted as a key intellectual influence, you can say, one of the great thinkers of our times, also for Russia. Of course, to India, where Lyndon LaRouche and Helga Sepp LaRouche also was just in December. But also to South America, to Africa, all over the world. And at a time when it has become fashionable, especially after 9/11 in the United States, of having a clash of civilizations as a new replacement for the Cold War, Helga Sepp LaRouche has actually been, together with her husband and the movement, a key player in actually setting up what you could call a dialogue of civilizations as a totally different concept of this. Of instead of putting the war to the world to war against each other, actually have a collaborations between the different sovereign nation states, between the different civilizations, for actually getting the world out of what everybody now has to recognize is the biggest crisis we've seen in not only in recent time, but also in modern times. At the same time, Helga Sepp LaRouche has also been the key figure, especially from in February 1997, she made the first appeal, gathering together politicians, diplomats, scholars of different kinds for an appeal for a new Bretton Woods financial system to replace the present, what she already at that time identified together with LaRouche as a international financial system that was prone to have a systemic collapse at any time. And therefore, she has been not just making one call, but a series of calls and trying to gather political leaders of recognizing this and actually set up policies to deal with it. So instead of trying then to list for the next 3 hours all of the initiatives that Helga Sepp LaRouche has been and are involved in, I think I'll just let her make an introductory remarks, which we will record, and then we'll turn off the recordings, and then we'll have an open and frank discussion. So please welcome Helga Sepp LaRouche.
Thank you. I would like to tell you that yesterday evening my husband made a webcast in Washington, which you may not have seen, but if you haven't seen it, I would really encourage you to look at it, because my husband is generally known that he does not mince words. And yesterday he was extremely outspoken, even for my experience with him. But I think it is absolutely crucial, because he is right now engaged in an effort to save the Obama presidency. And that is a not so certain proposition right now, because you all know that Obama came in with a tremendous popularity of 78% of the population supporting him, and that has shrunk already in the meantime to below 40%, then on his person it's up a little bit, but on his policies it's down to 35%. And that means that the window of opportunity for Obama to fulfill the promises he made during the election campaign is actually closing relatively soon, especially in light of the fact that the policies adopted by the G20 at the London summit are not working. Even if the G20 governments and the central banks decided on the biggest bailout policy ever, the real economy is continuing to collapse. It's in a free fall. If you look at the figures, you can actually say that we are in a crisis which is already much worse than that of the 1920s and 30s. And if even the Financial Times Germany, you know, which is not exactly a revolutionary organ, is talking about the biggest crisis in history, I think it is a reflection of the spirit of the time. So in light of this, what my husband is trying to do right now with this webcast, and this webcast was not just in Washington, but he was hooked up with a group of very important politicians, economists, journalists, and historians in New York, and then from there in California and many other places in Latin America and elsewhere. In Mexico, they did not have the planned webcasts because they had to cancel them because of the swine flu, but in all other places they did function. And there was a very important dialogue, which you shortly can read in our publication, EIR, of people who are part of the Obama administration in part, and who are equally concerned. Because, you see, while Obama in the election campaign and in the beginning of his election, of his presidency, did say a couple of things and did a couple of things which were actually quite promising. Now, you should know that we did not initially support him. We were supporting Hillary Clinton in the campaign because we thought she was a much better economist, because, you know, she very clearly, if you read or you listen to her speeches in the internet from New Hampshire onward, she was always talking about the invisible Americans she would defend. And she clearly went in the direction of an FDR profile. So, you know, if you have questions about this, I can take them up in the question and answer period. In any case, Obama became president despite the fact that Hillary had more popular votes up to the primary ending sometimes in June. But when he became president, to our great pleasure, he appointed not so much the people from the Soros, George Soros camp, which we, you know, had criticized a lot during the campaign, that you know, Soros people were putting a lot of money into Obama. But he appointed a lot of Clinton people. First of all, naturally, Hillary Clinton became the Secretary of State, but also a lot of people from the Clinton administration, with which we felt much more comfortable. So it looked actually quite good, and my husband made the commitment that he would do everything possible to make sure that the Obama presidency would succeed, given the fact that, you know, the role of the United States in this moment of great crisis is absolutely unique, because if the U.S. is not able to overcome the crisis, then it looks pretty bleak for the rest of the world. And, you know, there were promising signs in the beginning, up to the point when Obama went to London to the G20 summit, where he all of a sudden reversed previous policies and completely endorsed the bailout plan of Gordon Brown, and with that practically the British Empire. Then he made promises in the discussions with President Medvedev, going in the direction of a disarmament agreement with Russia. But then he went to Prague, and then he made a very bellicose speech, which, you know, basically implied, even if he didn't say it explicitly, that he would go ahead with the anti-ballistic missile systems in Czechia and Poland. At least that was what the Czech population concluded from his speech. And then it became clear that contrary to the initial Clinton people, you know, people like Gates, people like Eric Holder, that's Fridus. that basically the Soros people came back in the person of Larry Summers. Larry Summers, who briefly was finance secretary at the end of the Clinton administration in 1999, where he personally was responsible for the kind of deregulation policies which allowed the so-called locusts, the hedge funds, the private equity funds, to basically go in full takeover by eliminating the famous Glass-Steagall Act, which was introduced by Roosevelt as a consequence of the Great Depression of the 30s, which separated very clearly commercial banking and investment banking. And when the Glass-Steagall Act was abolished, then you know you had this complete increase of the so-called creative financial instruments, you know, taking over completely. So at that point, you know, we looked at the situation, and we also had important discussions with people from the Obama camp, and it was clear that Wall Street had made a certain amount of a coup, or was trying to do that by putting on in Larry Summers, by putting in the strange species of behavioral economists. Now that has nothing to do with economists. This is a special school of economists who basically say the neocons were mistaken because they believed that man is rational because he always can count on his greed, and therefore there is rationality in the system. And they changed it basically in mixing the findings of behaviorist psychology, which is a kookish thing in the first place, with neurology, brain studies, and therefore, you know, basically thinking that they have a mechanic way of manipulating the brain and manipulating the behavior of the population. And unfortunately, these people gained much notoriety with Obama. So my husband made a webcast on the 11th of September April, where he demanded that the only way how the United States can get out of this crisis is by kicking out Larry Summers and by kicking out all of these people from Chicago, and that Obama should go back and rely on the other members of his cabinet, where there are a lot of competent economists, including people like Paul Volcker, Paul Krugman, and others who had been pushed to the side. Now, you can imagine that the Obama administration was not so pleased about that, because my husband also warned that, you know, that Obama had proven on his trip a narcissist syndrome, that he liked too much crowds cheering him, that he, you know, changed his opinion. And actually people in the administration made a comparison, and they compared what did he say to one person and what did he say to the next person, and they realized that he was not consistent in what he was saying. And for the President of the United States, this is a pretty bad thing. So therefore, you should know this when you look at this webcast, because the harshness of the tone of Mr. LaRouche is only to be explained by his desire to make this presidency of Obama function. And, you know, fortunately there are a lot of people in this administration who fully agree with what he is doing. And, you know, there is a general agreement that you have to have a correction of this administration early on, that you cannot wait, you know, down the road until everything is hardened, because the window of opportunity for Obama to change policy is not going to be open very long. Because what you have right now is a breakdown crisis of the economy. If you look at the figures, I think they are breathtaking to anybody, you know, in history. This has never happened. For example, the Japanese export in January and February collapsed on a yearly basis by around 50%. Now, that is not little for an export nation. If you look at the Chinese figures, naturally their export market in the United States is collapsing because the U.S. economy is plunging into a deep depression. I mean, as a matter of fact, the U.S. domestic economic picture is horrifying, because you have alone in the last months, in 1 month, you had an increase of unemployment by over 600,000 in one single month. You have right now basically all major states bankrupt. California is de facto bankrupt. It has a budget deficit of $42 billion, which for one state is not exactly peanuts. You have a catastrophe where, you know, because the measures proposed by my husband in August 2007 have not yet been implemented, you have millions of people losing their homes. You have the growth of so-called Obama cities in the suburbs in California and Florida. These are people who are living in their cars, they're living in tents, and they're calling them Obama cities because, you know, naturally the blame will go to Obama. And the rage of the population is increasing because, you know, they see all of this criminality. They see Madoffs, the former head of Nasdaq, you know, not a minor figure, swindled his clients for $50 billion. And in the U.S., these clients were pension funds, health funds. In Europe, it was more royals, old nobility, money nobility. But in the United States, it's more people who really lose their pension and people lose their health care. Then Sir Stanford, the next swindler, who defrauded his clients by $12 billion in Antigua, which he turned, this island, he turned into a major money laundering place for drug traffic from Latin America. Then the next one and the next one. And then, you know, at the same time, the Geithner plan continued exactly what Paulson had done before. There was no change, and people are not stupid. They see that if the Obama administration is doing exactly what the Bush administration was doing in terms of Paulson, in terms of Geithner, well, it's, you know, this president was hated for good reasons. And then, naturally, they see that the AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the United States, was bailed out with $180 billion taxpayers' money. And then what happens with that money? $10 billion goes to Societe Generale, $12 billion goes to Deutsche Bank, and so forth and so on. So all this taxpayer money goes to foreign banks and foreign investors. You know, and eventually the American taxpayer says, we are going bankrupt, we are losing our livelihood, our jobs, our homes, and, you know, the government is bailing out foreign investors who just had the misfortune of misspeculating. So the rage factor is growing, and it's very dangerous because you already have the right wing of the Republican Party, people like, you know, Newt Gingrich or Rush Limbaugh. I mean, these are really demagogues and populists, and they are making talk shows and they're hyping and say, we will do everything to make the Obama administration fail, which is utterly irresponsible because if Obama fails, the whole world is going to fail. But they're doing it, and then you have naturally the militias, you know, arming themselves. There are warnings that social unrest may occur. People are buying more weapons than ever before because they figure that Obama may change the weapon laws at some point. So you have a powder keg building up domestically, which is not to be underestimated. Now, if you look at the other economies, they are not in better shape. In Europe, for example, the Eurozone is about to disintegrate, which is something which does not come as a surprise for us. Because, you know, we from the beginning said the euro cannot function. You cannot have economic, financial, monetary unity when you do not have political unity. I mean, that was the big discussion at the beginning of the euro. And now it is disintegrating. Look at the indebtedness of the southern so-called Club Mediterranean countries, Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain. Some of these countries, because of their high indebtedness, have to pay 2 to 3% more interest rate for any new credit they are taking than, let's say, Germany. And there is already a big discussion, when will it become too expensive for these countries to remain within the Eurozone? And naturally, the problems of the Baltic. I think Denmark has been affected in part by that situation. The situation in Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe is in a terrible condition. Ukraine just got 16 billion euro bailout, but you know, from the IMF, but with terrible conditions attached to it, which leads to social unrest again. Then you have Hungary, Czechia, Poland, all of these countries, Romania, are in terrible condition, and the German taxpayer is supposed to bail out all of these countries, which doesn't really go to these countries. It goes to the Austrian banks who have over-engaged in the East European countries, to the Swiss banks, and this thing will become untenable very soon. So that is not a good situation. But then if you look at the German economy, the so-called strongest economy in Europe, it is collapsing. The export figures for machine tool in February on a yearly basis went down 23.7%. Now, that is almost a quarter. You know, and for a very long time, you know, Germany was hailed to be the export champion of the world. But now it turns out that that export championship at the expense of a strong domestic market is exactly the Achilles heel, which is what we said all the time, because a country has to have first a strong domestic economy and then go for export and international trade. But you cannot have your engine only on an export orientation, while the real wages in Germany since the introduction of the euro de facto have been collapsing or stagnating or going down. So therefore you have a terrible crisis right now, and this will get worse and worse and worse. And what the G20 has decided is to go for a hyperinflationary bailout on top of the approximately, it's very difficult to say exactly, because a lot of this money has been pumped, not officially, but for example, estimates are that the United States, since the beginning of the crisis in August 2007, pumped approximately $25 trillion into the system. Part of it was official bailout packages, stimulus packages, but in part it was also just liquidity used to prevent collapses. And Europe has done similar things, Asia has done similar things. So with the decision now of the G20 to pump another $6 trillion dollar, which they can right now not raise because, you know, the British were not able to sell state bonds at the recent auction. But nevertheless, it's basically the decision to open the sluices, which they call euphemistically quantitative easing. Now, quantitative easing is Orwellian doublespeak for printing money. I mean, the Bank of England openly printed £150 billion. This was allowed by the British government. The IMF, an institution which had been utterly discredited, because the IMF, if you go to places in Southeast Asia and you ask people about the IMF, they have the lowest opinion of the IMF, because the IMF did not warn of the Asia crisis in 97. And when the Asian countries were down, you know, they got kicked by the IMF in addition. So, you know, the IMF was really discredited. And now all of a sudden they pull it out of the hat like a rabbit. And the IMF is supposed to be the big savior of the world with special drawing rights. But special drawing rights are nothing but quantitative easing on an international scale. Printing money and keeping the bailout. Now, if you keep doing what they are doing right now, what you will see is a continuous collapse of the real economy, which is just coming down like a ton of bricks. Just look at GM, Chrysler, Opel, the entire auto sector, the suppliers, the steel. It's just coming down, and there is nothing you can do in this context of the present system. So if you keep pumping money while the real economy is going flat, what is building up very, very quickly is a hyperinflationary bubble. Now, don't be fooled that people are talking about deflation. I know that in the financial media there is a big debate, is this deflation, is it inflation, should we inject liquidity to get the economy going, and can the central banks, after we have done that, take this excess liquidity out again? I mean, this all, I shouldn't say it, but I'm about to say this all nonsense, but, you know, I mean, just ask yourself a question. Why should you believe people who did not predict the crisis, who until very recently said, oh, nobody could foresee this crisis, we were all so surprised, nobody could imagine the dimension of the crisis. Why should you believe people now that they have any clue of why this crisis happened or when it will end? They don't. They just put out propaganda. In the case of the German government, our very noble economic minister, Mr. von und zu Gutenberg, who has about 16 prenames, which I didn't learn by heart yet, he, who is not an economist, he's just a PR skilled person. He predicted that the upturn will occur in the last part of 2009. Naturally, when you know that the German election is on the 27th of September, he is in a safe position because it's supposed to come after that, so nobody can expect it to come before. But, you know, this is all not based on anything, because what you have in reality, if you keep up what they're doing right now, you will have a continuous free fall of the economy, where one segment after the other will be affected, and then you will have a hyperinflationary explosion. Now, if you look at what happened in Weimar Germany in 1923, Germany at the end of World War I had a tremendous debt from the cost of the war. And then on top of that, the Versailles Treaty dictated that Germany should pay the entire war debt of France, of Great Britain, of everybody else, and naturally the combination of the own debt plus this reparation far exceeded the ability of the German economy to pay. So what did the Reichsbank do? Well, they did do what Geithner is doing, Mr. Darling is doing. They just printed money, you know. And for a long time, nobody noticed, because, you know, everything, all money streams went. It was no problem. But then, in the spring of 1923, the French occupied the Rhineland, and the German working force went into a general strike against that. So the production came to a standstill. And then you had a very fast explosion of hyperinflation. You know, in May, you may have paid a pound for a pound of bread, Reichsmark. Then in June, 10. In July, 100. In September, 1 million. In October, 1 billion. In November, 1 trillion. And then it came to a screeching halt, because it was completely absurd. I still have from my relatives these notes, you know. I'm a billionaire because I have these notes. But, you know, what happened then, naturally, the thing was ended because it became ridiculous, and then the Dawes plan bailed out Germany from the outside, you know. The problem is, today there is no outside. It's the whole world economy. And if you have a hyperinflationary process with the euro, the yen, and the dollar, then this will affect every single place of the world. And even Denmark, I hate to tell you, even Denmark will not escape this, because, you know, Danish people normally think that nothing ever can happen bad in Denmark, because it's such a cute little country with such a cute language. You know, everything will be nice. It is a cute little country, but it will not be spared. So, you know, what happened in Germany then later was that the people used these notes as wallpaper because it was cheaper to take these notes than to buy actually wallpaper. And anyway, so this is the danger. Now, obviously, if this happened, it would be a breakdown of civilization, because already now you can see that the austerity policies of the IMF, the so-called conditionality policies of the IMF since the middle of the 70s, towards Africa, towards Latin America, towards Asia, has created this problem. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and globalization became unrestricted, you know, with cheap labor in China and other places, I mean, look at the result of these policies, even without what I just said. Look at the fact that there are maybe a couple of thousand billionaires, there are a couple of million millionaires, but two-thirds of the human civilization lives terrible. Africa is a dying continent. Look at what happens now with the swine flu. It's not an accident that it started to erupt in Mexico, because Mexico has been one of the victims of this globalization, of NAFTA, of the cheap labor production. The unemployment in Mexico is more than 50%. Mexico has just been declared a failed state together with Pakistan by the U.S. Supreme Command. The narco-terrorists have taken over. The country is literally run by narco-terrorism. They have more money and better weapons than the army and the police. They just killed recently the U.S. negotiator for kidnapping victims. Well, there was an agreement that, you know, there was one person from the United States who would go every time when somebody was kidnapped, and that is a business in Mexico, and not only in Mexico. Then this person would be the official negotiator negotiating a ransom and the release of these people. Now they killed him as a sign to say who is ruling this country. You know, and narco-terrorism is becoming a major problem, not only for Latin America, the United States, where, you know, a lot of drugs are entering the United States. And, you know, if you have a drug epidemic like that, you have no next generation. If 80 or 90% of your youth are taking drugs, you can forget the cognitive potential of a society. People don't remember the brains they lose in drugs. You know, and the same thing goes naturally for Afghanistan and Europe, which is affected by this in a similar way. So it's no accident that this flu pandemic, the swine flu, erupted in Mexico, because the living standard has been lowered over a longer period of time. And when you do that to a population, naturally you create the conditions for a pandemic. So when Mr. LaRouche is making the point that if this policy is continued, and you will have a collapse of the real economy, a hyperinflationary blowout, then the condition for a worldwide biological holocaust and pandemics like the swine flu and other mutations is just going to happen. And then the collapse of civilization from presently 6 billion to something like 2 billion or less is a real possibility. Now, when we are talking about the worst crisis in civilization, you know, worse than the 14th century, where you had a similar collapse, where the banking system of Bardi and Peruzzi banking houses were collapsing because of similar policies of looting and austerity. And then, naturally, you had the Black Death killing one-third of the population. You had flagellants, you had witch burning. You had a general collapse of the population who went insane. If you look at the pictures of Bosch and Bruegel, you know, where you have these people, one eye up with the other one down, these painters were painting a dark age. You know, and that is happening right now. The modern form of flagellants are Twitters. You know, people who, you know, like in the case of Moldavia right now, organize per internet violent attacks on government buildings. They, you know, come for 2 minutes, then they disseminate, so the police cannot get them. And this is an insane phenomenon, but it's also a sign of the breakdown of society. I mean, if you look at what could happen in terms of social consequences, we are reaching a point where armies cannot solve this problem anymore. Because if you have more than 1 million people in the street, you cannot use the army or the police. You cannot tell the army shoot into 2 million people. I mean, first of all, many of these people will have relatives who are policemen or people in the army, and, you know, as you can see in the case of Albania in 1997, when these pyramid schemes collapsed, you know, in one day all of Albanian banking shut down, you put in your credit card, and then this terrible noise happens, which is this nightmare noise. But then, you know, what happened? People started to storm food stores, they started to storm weapon depots, and the police and the army were among those who were storming these places. Because people are people, they want to eat. So we are looking at a potential hell if we don't change it. Now, how to change it is very easy. Because we need to have a renewed discussion of a real new Bretton Woods conference. Now, Roosevelt, in 1933, with the New Deal, clearly demonstrated how it was possible to lead the United States out of the Depression, contrary to Mussolini, Hjalmar Schacht, and Hitler, who went in the other direction. But Roosevelt, who was the, you know, fundamental opposition against these policies with the New Deal, by simply providing state credit to everybody who wanted to produce something meaningful, you know, got the United States back into production. And then in 1944, with the Bretton Woods system, he established a new financial monetary system, you know, which was intended to end colonialism forever. Now, if you look at the debate between Churchill and Roosevelt in Casablanca, which is reported by the son of Roosevelt in this book, As I Saw It, Roosevelt was totally determined to end colonialism and establish the policy of the American Revolution of John Quincy Adams to have an alliance of perfectly sovereign republics where the United States would not be an empire, maybe primus inter pares, but, you know, having a totally sovereign alliance of republics. Now, unfortunately, Roosevelt died in April 45, and Truman was an utterly Anglophile president who basically left it all to Churchill to determine the post-war order. So, therefore, you know, when my husband says, when did this crisis start? He said it started the day Truman came into office, because that was when things started to go in the wrong direction. But we can today reconnect to the New Deal, to Bretton Woods, and we need to have an emergency conference of a new Bretton Woods. Now, remember that, you know, our courts, and Tom was already referring to it, that in 1997, I, together with a Ukrainian parliamentarian called Natalia Vitrenko, called for a new Bretton Woods, and we collected literally thousands of signatures of parliamentarians, of economists, of other important people, because it was clear this system had to be replaced. And in the recent period after the you know, the eruption of this global financial crisis, all of a sudden, all kinds of people were talking about new Bretton Woods. President Sarkozy said, we need a new Bretton Woods. Tremonti, naturally, is a strong advocate. And at the first G20 meeting on the 15th of November in Washington last year, that was supposed to define a new Bretton Woods. And the April meeting of the G20 was supposed to talk about new Bretton Woods. But then, you know, magic, all of a sudden, you know, this word disappeared, and at the London summit, nobody was talking anymore about it because they were talking about, you know, IMF and all of these things, but no more. But this policy is now going to fail, and it will be absolutely clear, and you know, it will be very apparent to everybody that this policy is going to be a complete, utter disaster. So therefore, you know, the reason why I'm here and the reason why, you know, we have this meeting and other such meetings is because we need to have a discussion among intelligent people preparing for the next phase, because, you know, when it is clear that this present policy is failing, then there will be an outcry for some real policy. And, you know, my husband has said since a long time that because of the power of the British Empire and the financial oligarchy, who naturally do not want a change of the system, that the only way you can have a change is by putting the four most important power together: the United States, Russia, China, and India. And then you can have other nations, sovereign countries attaching themselves, and, you know, then changing the system. Now, what should occur is an agreement to cancel the toxic waste, because all of these bailouts by the banks of maybe anywhere between 40 and 50 trillion so far, why do they do that? Because you have, ever since Alan Greenspan invented the so-called creative financial instruments starting in 1987, the derivatives, the derivative credits, and all these other things like special structured investment vehicles, commercial-backed assets, mortgage-backed assets, packaged together with other papers into packages, resold again, then you turn debt into assets, you repackage that, you sell it again. This is all completely unserious. You cannot take a debt and resell it repeatedly in that way, building the pyramid, and then you end up with something like, nobody knows exactly, but, you know, the figures which were published by Jacques Attali in France, 1.4 quadrillion toxic waste in the banks. Now, that is a one and then 16 figures behind it. It's 16,000 trillions. Or forget it, it's too much. I have to write it on paper. It's an enormous amount. If you keep trying to bail this out, you know, well, I mean, first of all, if you look at the substance of what they did at the G20 meeting, they have not done anything to block that. They have not regulated the hedge funds. They have not closed the tax havens. They have not re-regulated. So therefore, what happens, you take 180 billion taxpayer money, you give it to AIG, because otherwise, you know, they have a systemic collapse. AIG gives it to Deutsche Bank. They give it to Société Générale, UniCredit. Now, why should these banks do anything different than what they did before? You know, they keep high-risk business, they make more profit, but they keep accumulating these mountains. Now, this is completely crazy, and therefore, you know, if you try to maintain it, and naturally the pressure comes from the people who have invested in these things. They would say, we want 100% of our investment, even if it's toxic waste. We have invested, that's our good right. No, and the problem is, you know, Mr. Tremonti, who is the only reasonable economic minister in all of Europe, in my view, he shares our view on that. He says, you know, if you take this out of the books, you're not losing anything because it's just virtual. You know, I say always, you know, I mean, since this is only virtual money, all you need to do is take a computer, push the delete button, and the whole thing goes out of the window. Huh? It's very easy. It's a nightmare for some people, but, you know, it's only money, you know, not even real money. So what do you lose? Mr. Tremonti says correctly, you know, only God can save everybody. We can only try to save what's worth to be saved. No, and what's worth to be saved is the real economy. Now, Mrs. Merkel says, you know, oh, we have to bail out hypo real estate because it's systemic. What is systemic about hypo real estate? People have very short memories, because when UniCredit took over Bayerische Vereinsbank a couple of years ago, everybody knew that they separated out hypo real estate as a bad bank, you know. So why should this be systemic now? Mrs. Merkel says Opel is not systemic. Now that is crazy, because it takes much, much more time to build a very complicated high-tech machine tool design, machine tool capacities like Opel is a good plant. You know, they have a very good machine tool capacity, they have excellent, relatively excellent cars. Now why should you close this down? No, it's a crime. It's a crime against humanity, because if you're not fixated in money, but if you are a believer in real economy, then you can understand immediately that the amount of physical capacities, of machine tool, of industrial capacities, has a direct correlation to the capacity of the earth to maintain people. I mean, you can see it, you know, why is Germany so much more productive than most African countries? Because we have infrastructure, we have industry, we have, you know, very well developed system. Now, if you take that away, then the population density of the country can only support so much less people. And since the global economy is interconnected, when you destroy 30-40% of industrial capacities, you write on your desk, you know, the death penalty for so many percent of people. People don't think this way, but it is like that, because there is a connection between physical economy and population density, which can be carried by the earth. Now, therefore, what we are saying is this must be changed, and, you know, we should have a new system, a new Bretton Woods system. We write off most of these derivative and other debt, because they're unpayable. Berlin cannot pay its debt ever. With Mr. Wobereit as a mayor, forget it. You may as well kiss Berlin goodbye. You know, they have now 65 billion euro debt, and they have deindustrialized this place. All he's bringing in is fashion and movies and other things, you know, but in a depression you don't eat fashion and you don't eat movies, you know. So African countries, most countries cannot pay the debt. There are also illegitimate debt. Why should countries be forced to pay debt which they have been accumulating because of the IMF changing the conditionality, lowering the living standard, lowering the value of the currency, making the debt more expensive? So write off most of this, then earmark what should be saved in the new system. What you want to save is wages, you want to save pensions, you want to save credit to the middle-level industry, public banks which are providing these credits. You want to save everything which belongs to the common good, and the government has to put a state protection over these things. You know, which in Germany we have all the laws which are necessary. For example, in Germany the so-called Growth and Stability Law of 1967, together with the Bankenenquete of 68, we have the legislation to implement what I'm saying. Okay, then the next thing is you want to get rid of the old debt, go to a system of fixed exchange rates, because you do not want currency speculators like Mr. Soros to speculate a currency down in a week. You know, President Mahathir of Malaysia used to say that Soros is a criminal, because he destroyed the value of the Malaysian currency, what took the Malaysian population 40 years to build up, he speculated down in 1 week. And he said such people are criminals, and I agree. So then you need fixed exchange rates, which can be corrected after time, you know, adjusted, but fixed exchange rate, then you need to go from a monetary system to a system of a credit system. The credit system, which is in the American Constitution, which was implemented by Alexander Hamilton for the first time, who basically made a national bank, and the power to generate currency and credit lies only with the sovereign government and the parliament, or in that case the Congress, not with private bankers. Why should a private banker in Cayman Island have the right to create currency and credit, which is out of control of anybody? That is what went wrong after 71, when Nixon decoupled the dollar from the gold and eliminated the fixed exchange rate system, which was when Mr. LaRouche was saying, this will lead to a new depression. So you need a national bank. The national bank has to issue credit to a network of local and regional banks who provide these credits to industries for useful purposes. And the government has many ways of encouraging the common good and punishing private vice. You know, the reality is contrary to Mondeville, who says, you know, the private crime leads to the common good. Because you have prostitutions, you need doctors who treat the patients who have venereal diseases, therefore prostitutions are good. Or bandits are good because they give employment to the lawyers. I mean, that is what these people think. I have recently met somebody who argued this. No, the government can do the opposite, and you can, if somebody makes an investment in basic research and development, he gets a tax incentive or even tax exemption altogether because it serves the common good. If somebody wants to build a casino or a prostitution house, well, if this person has to pay 99% taxes, he may consider maybe it's better to go into basic research and development. So the idea that the government has no power to encourage the economy is just not true. The government must create the framework condition for the private entrepreneur to function freely and creatively, but the framework, like infrastructure, health system, pension system, these things should not be privatized. Because if you privatize these things, then you know you have a two-caste system. In Germany, we already have a three-caste system. You have private patients who have a lot of money. They can pay whatever. You know, they pay whatever treatment they want. They get it and they live longer. Then you have normal patients who go to the doctor and now they have to pay that extra and that extra, and this treatment you have to pay all yourself, and you end up with enormous bills, but there are some people who just barely can manage to do that. And then you have a third class of people who don't even go to the doctor anymore because they know they don't want to pay the €5 for the prescription, and they don't have the 50 or 150 or 200 or 500 euro for the special treatment, so they don't go to the doctor and therefore they die early. Like in the third world, it is commonplace. And this has to stop. You know, if you want to have a human society, if you want to have a vision, I mean, we are not animals, we are not, you know, elbow society where the fittest is surviving. We are human beings and we have to have a vision of how do we want to have the 21st century. And, you know, I mean, why can we not go to an order where everybody can live in a decent human life, where we cherish what is human about us as distinct from all other species? And what is human about us is that we are potentially creative. You know, the thing which a government which does not encourage the creative powers of their own population, they should not be the government. The government should make sure that the potential of every child, of every student, of every older person is to the maximum developed, because contrary to the free trade doctrine, which says, you know, the source of wealth is to buy cheap and to sell expensive, and you should be the middleman, you know, to extract as much profit out of it, which is what the WTO is preaching, what the IMF is preaching, what the Doha round is preaching. Who gains from the Doha round? It's Monsanto and a couple of other grain cartels who have patents on food. This is insane. You should not have that. You should have a system where it is understood that the only source of wealth in a society is the creative power of the population. Because it is only the ability of man to discover universal principles again and again. And when these universal principles, which you call scientific progress, are turned into a technology, you know, somebody makes a discovery. A scientist has a fundamental breakthrough. Then he goes to a firm and says, look, can I speak to your engineers? How can you turn this scientific discovery into a technology? And then the engineers, you know, figure it out, they turn it into a technology, then this technology is being implemented in the production. And then it leads to an increase of productivity, and that leads to an increase of wealth, of living standard, of life expectancy, and that way you improve civilization. You know, and that is the only rational way. Everything else is just for a small group of looters at the expense of everybody else. And if we do not go to a different system which puts man and his human potential, his cognitive power, in the center, we are not going to make it out of this crisis. And there has to be a radical change in the axioms, because all of these people, you know, I mean, here we have, just think about it, we have the largest, biggest, most severe crisis in human civilization, where the life of billions of people is in danger. And what do the governments do? They have not even made an analysis of the reasons. They're just bailing out, putting money. But they have not looked at the reasons for the crisis. And the reasons for the crisis have been identified by Mr. LaRouche for the last 40 years. At every step of the misdirection, he put his finger there and says, this went wrong. If you continue this, it will have the following consequences. And now is the time to do that kind of an in-depth analysis of what went wrong and correct it. Now go to a different kind of a system. If you want to survive as a human civilization without having to go through a dark age for 3, 4, 5 generations, and then the human race will crawl back out of the pit somehow, they sure will, but none of us will be the benefiters of that experience. You know, so I have a vested interest that we change it now. And I think everybody who is not completely, you know, into this money thing immediately can see that that's the reasonable thing to do. So that is what I really wanted to say. And, you know, we should fight to get the new Bretton Woods back on the agenda, get governments to reconsider this whole thing, and hopefully we can do it in time before it's too late.